In 6 days, your brother will turn. Will you open the door? The Time We Have is now live on BackerKit, a tragic two-player zombie TTRPG played on opposite sides of a closed door. Inspired by games like For the Queen, this game is contained in an 80-card tarot-sized deck that you can grab right now on our BackerKit campaign. The Time We Have is written and designed by Elliot Davis, with illustrations by Ripley Ash, editing by Samantha Lee, and the theme song you're hearing by Behold. So please head to sadzombiegame.com or search The Time We Have on BackerKit and help us make this game a reality. Thank you. Hey, Brian.
Hey, Elliot.
What's the talk of the table?
Today, we are joined by Jay Stroutman and B. Marsolier, the co-GMs of Planet Arcana, and now the co-designers of the upcoming tarot-infused TTRPG, A Fool's Errand. Jay and B, welcome back to the show.
Woo! Welcome. Thank you. Wow.
Two repeaters.
I genuinely didn't know that you did the Hey Brian, Hey Elliot live. I thought that was a one take thing that you reused. And so it was really delightful to get right
in the
mood.
Really, that got me really jazzed up for this.
We do it every time.
Jay, you've been here before.
I didn't remember.
Oh, well. Shows how much you care. Anyway, JB, so good to see you. Sorry, folks, that's the energy. Unfortunately, J and B are friends of ours, in addition to being peers that we respect a whole lot.
Y'all listen to us be insufferable. This
is going to be a little insufferable. JB, today we want to talk to you about the journey that you have taken in creating A Fool's Errand, a journey from actual play to actual game. We want to talk about how the production and co-GMing of Planet Arcana.
You're too proud of it. I'm sorry.
I am so proud of it. I am so proud of it.
Yeah, you should be. You should
I
be.
Should.
Own
it's
it.
Good, Brian, and I won't apologize.
I'm just saying, we got to highlight it in some way, whether it's to mock or to praise, but there had to be a moment. Otherwise, the audience wouldn't have forgiven us.
No. But yeah, we want to talk about how the production and co-GMing of Planet Arcana has sort of informed this journey and what this game is going to look like. But first, Jay, my first gotcha question.
Oh, no.
We spoke to you right around this time last year. And,
true.
You were a little unwilling to use the title game designer for yourself, if I remember correctly. And now we're here talking to you about a game you're designing. How do you feel about the title game designer these days?
At the time, when I was hesitant, I had released one game, and so I was feeling a little unsure of myself. Now I've released a total of 2 games.
That's 100% more games.
That's 100% more games. And so I really took away you pushing me to just call myself a game designer after that. And it really is a state of mind. It's kind of a lifestyle, if you will. But I feel like, especially in the depths of having done so much work for A Fool's Errand, I definitely feel so in the game designer zone now that there's no question for me anymore of whether I am or not.
And that's all we want.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, that's it, everybody. Goodbye.
And I think before we get into A Fool's Errand, I think there's a flow that we should go into so we define all of our terms to start. So B, Fool's Errand was originally derived from Planet Arcana, your guys' podcast. For anyone who hasn't listened to Planet Arcana, despite our repeated recommendations, can you just give people a primer on what Planet Arcana is?
Sure. Planet Arcana is a science fantasy adventure in essence. The hook is that it begins with a heist and the gods of the world are the major arcana of the tarot. That's sort of like the essential primer. And then if you want to get into themes, we've got like high absurdity and high drama. We've got some like noir vibes, some Western vibes. It's kind of an identity crisis of a science fantasy story, and we wouldn't have it any other way.
And you're on episode 76 now?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Incredible.
And it's a game that is described in the trailer as like tarot-infused 5th edition. At what point did you guys start to see that you wanted to create an original system and like start to move further and further away from 5e?
Ooh, I feel like this leads into our first little secret. And this is a two-part secret. The first part of the secret is that we went into this knowing that we were going to at least pair it with a setting book at some point. And the second part of the secret is that what has happened from Planet Arcana to A Fool's Errand is not just, it didn't start with Planet Arcana. It started when B and I were like 9 and 11. So we've literally, we've been saying that we've been working on this game for like almost for decades, literally decades, to not age either of us.
Well, you did add the S at the end of decades. So, you know, the listener has to imagine at least 20.
We're 21 years old and we're ready to play.
Straight out the womb.
So I have to imagine that if that's the case, which is of working together since you were young, that part of that has to be tarot and the significance of tarot. And so for the two of you, when it comes to Planet Arcana and the game, what is the significance of tarot for you?
I'd love to hear Bea's answer on this because she was the one who got me into tarot.
I was very into tarot as a teenager. My relationship with it has changed significantly since then. But when we reached the point of doing the podcast, I thought that using the tarot was a really effective way of being able to introduce people to large concepts without a whole bunch of exposition. So, you know, if I tell you that there's a god called strength, you probably already have a basic idea of what that god stands for. And that's kind of what I like about tarot cards, is that they're just a collection of archetypes that are present in everybody's life, regardless of who you are. And everybody has at least some familiarity with these basic premises. And then we can start to kind of combine archetypes in unexpected ways without having to, you know, read off 5 pages of like who this god is and, you know, what they're all about and what the prehistory of like, no, you can just jump right into it and understand these big premises as like sweeping archetypes.
It is always fun to use those like very broad archetypes because they're understood enough that you can either lean into them and everyone gets it, or you can buck against them and everyone gets like the fun contrast of it.
Yeah. And now you have uncovered another theme of Planet Arcana the podcast.
Well, so I'm curious because Jay, you said that one of the secrets is that it was always going to be a setting book, but obviously now we know it's not a setting book. It's an original game system. Did elements of this game begin as you two homebrewing things in 5e?
I mean, we homebrewed the campaign so much for the podcast, but I feel like the game is something so completely different because it uses cards as a resolution mechanic, which is just so vastly different from a D20. I'm trying to think if we did homebrew anything from other than setting elements like the gods, the places, the dream and digital network, the fact that you can play robots and humans. Like, other than those elements, I can't think of anything that we took from the way that we play the game on the show to the way that we actually play mechanically the game in Fool's Errand.
So I think that leads us into a good thing of, we've been talking about Fool's Errand, we've been talking around Fool's Errand. Let's talk about Fool's Errand. Can you give me the pitch of what Fool's Errand is and kind of dive in a little bit on what the mechanics are?
Yeah, so A Fool's Errand is a tarot-fueled science fantasy role-playing game about playing the fools, keeping the gods in check, and preventing another big oops. Players start by building human or android fools, which is the zeroth card of the tarot, and they build unique tarot decks for their characters that kind of represent their abilities and relationships to different major arcana. And then the fool's adventure, they incite calamities to get stronger, but as they do, the major arcana become more and more involved, and as the major arcana become more involved, more calamities are incited, and it brings the world closer to the ultimate calamity, which is the big oops.
2.0.
2.0.
There's a lot in there. lot of juicy meaty stuff in there. So I guess one of the questions I want to ask is, what on earth is a big oops, and why are we making our own?
So the big oops is the biggest calamity that the world has ever seen. We have one in our podcast campaign, but for A Fool's Errand, we ask during session zero that the table decides together what their big oops is and how recently it happened. So that's kind of just like the prehistory of the world that you'll end up playing in, and then the ultimate disaster that you are leading the world to once more.
It is fun how often that's a core world building thing in a lot of like either actual plays or home games. It's like, here's the calamity that happened in the past. And now like having that just built into the game is really fun and like helping you build that. Cause usually that's the thing that feels like a big lore world building ask that this game makes a lot easier than what you would have to do on your own.
Thank you for that. Thank you for that. I feel like, okay, the one thing that I do feel like we ported over, it's less of a mechanic and more of an experience that we want to provide, is that I feel very frustrated at times with how D&D really puts everything on the DM's shoulder, not only in, you know, the fact that you, like, they do provide some world building stuff, but I don't know a lot of people who actually use like the I don't want to say vanilla, because I feel like that has a negative connotation, but I don't really know a lot of people who use the out of the book stuff. I feel like a lot of people are homebrewing, which is great. Both cases are great, but I've played so many games and I've been a GM for so long that this is my first game that I have made or co-made that has a GM. So my primary goal in this is to ensure that whoever GMs it has the easiest time building an expansive world, one that's unique to them and their group, but also supports them a lot for like the kind of story that they'll tell that will like really incorporate the players and their characters. And so I think if there's one thing that I did take from the way that we play D&D, it's almost like the thing that I'm missing from that is what was super important to incorporate into the game.
I do think that's a huge boon, and it's something that we've caught out on the show a lot, of the games that we find the most effective and the games that we end up loving the most are the ones that provide that very clear on-ramp, especially for the person running the game, because that's one of the biggest hurdles is, A, you've got to get someone to run the game. You've got to get a group together. And then it's got to be an easy enough on-ramp and an easy enough time for you to get the game started so that everyone can fall into play where everything gets easy. Once everyone's comfortable and in the door, everything's great. Getting there is one of the hardest parts.
Mm-hmm.
So, Jay, you said that this game is the first one that you've made with like a traditional GM role, and like you're taking a lot, you're obviously inspired by a podcast that is D&D, it is long form, it is campaign. I want to ask kind of either of you, who is this game for? Like, what kind of players, what kind of groups is this game for?
I think we would love for it to be a game that is like as accessible to people who have played lots of different types of games as it is to brand spanking new players. And I've been playing in a home game with some brand spanking new players, and I think we're heading in the right direction, which is really exciting. I think having that early investment in world building, like even before you start playing, is something that especially new players, it helps give them a sense of ownership and control over this world when they're still kind of touchy on the rules, which was a huge hurdle for me getting into something, like feeling like I had no ownership because I was, you know, even in terms of the mechanics, completely lost. So I hope that's something that we can achieve.
I would add to that too, that I feel like this game lends itself to campaigns, like more than a couple sessions, because that's what B and I were playing before we started the podcast, was we had like a 60 session long D&D campaign that was just like not recorded at all before this. So yeah, just something that you can really sink your teeth into for a long, long time.
And I do kind of want to dive into a bit of the mechanics, because this is a like tarot powered and like card drawing mechanical system, whereas dice are familiar. I mean, worst case scenario, if you've never seen a die before, you roll it, there's a number there, you're kind of like, okay, I could guess. A tarot deck is, even for someone who used to work as a professional magician, so is very familiar with cards, tarot deck is a little more intimidating of an object of play. I guess my two questions are, how familiar do I need to be with tarot to play this game? And how is the tarot deck used to work as a mechanical engine for the game system?
I would say you have to be 0% familiar with tarot to pick up the game. Because really, at the end of the day, the main mechanic is that you're drawing from one of your two decks that you've made for your character. And you have like a target number that relates to a skill. And you have to draw a card that lands equal to or under that number. So if you're trying to intuit something and your score is 8, you need to draw an 8 or lower card. So at the end of the day, it works similarly to dice, but something that I think is really freaking cool about a deck of cards is that when you're rolling a d20 and you are rolling like hot garbage and you're like, man, I'm due for a 20, that means nothing. That's fake. That's fake. But when you're drawing cards from a deck and you're like, man, I'm due to get my crit success, it's true, because you're literally whittling down the deck to get to the crit success. You can almost kind of see the progression of how you'll do in the session because you've used up certain cards. And that part really excites me about having a deck in front of you.
Yeah, you can do some actual gambling.
That's very good.
Yeah, dice don't have memory, but a deck of cards does.
It also feels, and I want to kind of emphasize, I really want to underline what you just said, because I feel like this is like something that we talk about that we love so much, is when theme and game mechanic line up so well. And I think like for a game about the gods meddling and like, you know, you're playing with these ideas of fate and these like big words like calamity and all this. And it's like, it makes sense that you would be able to like somewhat see the path through your mechanic rather than it being the randomness of a die. So I just want to really like kind of give a little flower to that, because that's very good.
Something I didn't mention also is that while you mostly have a deck of just like numbered valued cards, the wild cards, literally is the term that we're using, that we've thrown into the decks, are the major arcana. You have a very select few of them. And when they pop up, things escalate or get funky in line with that arcana's tenets. So like if you drew strength and you were trying to do something strengthful, there's probably a word for that, but I choose not to use it.
No, it's strengthful.
It's strengthful now.
You know what I mean.
As somebody who's playtested this game with you all, I think that there is something I want to ask you that is like, you don't just mean when the arcana come up as cards and mechanics. That also has a in fiction implication, correct?
Yes. Yeah, it's literally the gods reaching into your adventure to take their slice of it, almost to take their we kind of have framed it a little bit that they take credit for your successes, for your failures. They are yours, but the gods are kind of greedy in that way, greedy and jealous, and they take a little piece of you whenever you try to do something that they decide they need to have a hand in.
I do also love that drawing from a deck of cards in this way with the major arcana as wild cards, it has that, I'm still trying to figure out what the word is for this, but that like leap up, hell yeah moment of rolling a nat 20, of like instant excitement that like a lot of mechanics, if you're rolling like a dice pool, you've got to like, okay, I rolled 5 6s and 2 4s. Let's separate those out and figure out what that means. Drawing cards, for a lot of it, you're just like, okay, I rolled under, or I drew under, I drew under, I drew over, I drew over. Then all of a sudden you draw a wild card. It's like, boom, bam. I know what that means. I don't have to do any math. I don't have to think about it. I know a big thing is happening and I'm excited about it. And I think every system kind of wants that. It wants to have something like that, that is like a moment of jubilation, I guess.
Euphoria.
Euphoria. a euphoric game moment.
B and I have this little saying that we use a lot when we're prepping for an episode of the podcast, where if we find something that, like, because we're 76 episodes in, there's a lot that we're trying to tie into the beginning, especially as we're getting closer to the end. And so when we find little connections between stuff, we always say it writes itself, because it sometimes feel like there's an extra, like almost, you know, some kind of universe reaching into what we're writing and like kind of finding those connections for us. But I feel the same way when I play a game and something happens in it where it's like, that was exactly what needed to happen. And there's like a kind of magic to that. And I get really excited when like that couldn't have played out better. I feel like every time we draw Major Arcana, in the game, I feel like that because I'm always like, oh my god, that was the exact moment that like something weird needed to happen.
It does feel a bit spooky sometimes. And if you want to mythologize it that way, which I always do, it's really fun.
It is especially fun because if you see a nat 20, it just means, boom, you did it. If you see Wheel of Fortune, that could mean, like, depending on your knowledge of tarot, how much you want to dive into it, how much you just want to interpret it yourself, that excitement could mean a lot of different things rather than just, I did it. Rather than just, I did it, it is, I did it with this caveat or with this story. I can immediately start to form a story rather than just, I tried to leap over the building, I leapt over the building.
Right. I feel like so here's where people's brains might be going right now is like, oh no, if I GM this game, I have to manage 22 gods.
20.
Well, yeah, 20. That's right. We exclude the fool in the world from the pantheon.
So it's like, so if I'm a GM right now listening and I'm like, oh, I really want to run this game, but like, how do I run 20 gods? How do I think about a pantheon this big? Like, how does this game sort of help people who are sort of scared of that, how that sounds? Like, how is it actually not that bad, I guess?
Ample GM support, lots of tables, and essentially the meaning of the major arcana is kind of baked into as early as character creation. So when players are building their characters, part of that is to select motivations. Each of those motivations is related to a major arcana, and then they get put into the primary deck. Those are the ones that are typically going to end up involved in the story. So depending on the number of players you have, say you have 3 players at a table, you're going to have 9 major arcana to contend with, and you're already going to know a little bit about them because of the motivation that's associated with them. And then we also have like a handy dandy reference table that distills it to like 3 words per major arcana so that you have like the essence of the archetype to jump off from. We don't want to make it too prescriptive, but we do want to provide a lot of like incorporation of the theme of the major arcana into the actual game. So that's a goal that we have, is to make it incorporated as early as possible and to have it as streamlined and archetypal as possible to help people who aren't familiar with arcana. Tarot cards.
I would add to that too that it's not like every time a major arcana is drawn, the GM has to like personify them. It could be very symbolic, you know, like literally if you draw the moon, something could happen, especially if you draw it at night. You could just describe like the moon getting brighter or going behind a cloud or some such. But on the other hand, we also plan to, because B and I have done so many different voices for the arcana in the show that we've really thought about how you might play them if you'd like to. So I think as part of the major arcana section that we're going to have in the book, we want to have some notes of like how to role play them if you did want to personify them, and like, you know, voice notes if you did want to give them voices. So you could kind of play it either way. They could be like almost unknowable, that they don't actually chat with the players, or they could be, you know, just
actual
guys.
Characters.
Yeah. Guys that you run into.
A Fool's Errand is a tarot-fueled science fantasy game set in a post-calamity world of androids, humans, and all those in between. Build your fools and explore realms both waking and subconscious. But the more powerful you get, the more the major arcana gods will take notice and rain down their love and rage as both boons and calamities. Every calamity dreams its successor. The world approaches its next big oops. So, fool, will you deny these jealous gods? Back A Fool's Errand right now by visiting www.afoolserrandgame.com. Your errand awaits.
Hey there, it's Elliot from the Many Sided Media team. In addition to playing and producing here on My First Dungeon, I'm also a game designer, known for such games as Something Is Wrong with the Chickens, a rules-like game of chickens, eldritch horror, and revenge. Project Echo, a solo time travel game played in the pages of a planner.
and the upcoming Rom-Com Drama Bomb, a three-player game of Meet Cutes and Mayhem. If you like weird and unique games and want to bring something new to your table, head to moreblueberries.shop and use code MYFIRSTDUNGEON for 20% off your order. That's MOREBLUEBERRIES.shop. Thanks!
This game, though, it was built from Planet Arcana and like from the game that you're playing there, I don't have to listen to Planet Arcana to be able to play this game. It is a separate thing in the same way that you don't have to read the Die comics to play Die.
Exactly. But if you did?
But if you did, that'd be pretty cool.
It's some cool Easter eggs.
Yeah, literally. If you are a listener, there's going to be a ton of Easter eggs. You are going to feel like you're, you know, playing in the world of the podcast. If you don't know Planet Arcana, it doesn't matter. You don't need to know it.
But if you're listening to this, you should know Planet Arcana because we recommend it
often.
We truly can't be clearer here.
We can't.
You should listen to the podcast.
So I love that you just said that one of the tools you want to include is this kind of these things you've learned from playing these different Arcana on the podcast. And kind of what I want to transition into is talking about how obviously, we know there's a history before co-GMing, but we want to talk about the two of you moving from co-GMs to co-designers and how those kind of processes are similar, what you learned from them. I want to know kind of baseline, how did co-GMing prepare you to co-design?
Damn. Gotcha.
Fuck. You know what's fucked is like I don't remember starting to make this game. I don't remember chatting about it. I just at some point we were I don't know.
My earliest memory exactly is being on a call where we were like, well, so what do we call the game? And you said a fool's errand, but that was like months into it. I was thinking that's the earliest I can remember.
I really like the idea of like, what should we call it? A fool's errand. I'll start a doc, and you type in a fool's errand into the title, and you open the doc, and there's already 20 pages of stuff there
because it writes itself. Because
it literally
writes itself. I will say shout out to Sean for coming up with the name A Fool's Errand.
Because that was the name of our theme song for. Right. Since the very beginning. Yeah.
Mm. Oh, that's fun.
That's a fun little Easter egg.
Yeah. What was the question?
just how did co-GMing kind of prepare you to be co-designer?
Co-GMing is a really interesting thing that you would think it would save some time in prep and you would think it would save some time in other places. And it doesn't. It really adds a lot of time. Because you have to align on everything that you're thinking about. But similarly, you would think that you would like clash a lot or kind of run into each other a lot when you're DMing, and it really isn't like that at all. There's been so many benefits and ways that I've adapted playing games because of co-GMing. And I've said this before that like I really can't imagine myself going to solo GMing ever because it's been so rewarding. But B and I also always caveat that with but do it with someone that you've known for decades and you've been working on artistic projects with for decades.
Easy.
So, I mean, there's just a lot of compromise, especially when you're making a huge world like we are, which is the game is just a continuation of that. But we have so many of the same touchstones because we grew up together that it just... I think that we just have it easier than if someone else tried this, I don't think they'd have as easy of a time as B and I have had.
Yeah.
I'm really struggling to find the answer of like how we transition because again, I just don't remember. Ever.
I would say like if you do double GM something with somebody, you can probably design a game with them.
Yeah.
You probably do just about anything with them, it sounds like.
Yeah. I would say.
Yeah. It actually turns out if you co-GM with someone, a game just is born.
It just manifests.
It just happens.
You just find the doc in your Google Drive one day and it's...
All you gotta do is figure out the name and then it's there. then you start the kickstarting process.
Well, we recently spoke with Will Yopes, who I know is a friend of y'all's, and Will was talking about collaborating with Adam Vass and how Adam said this thing to Will once where it was like, once you bring something to this collaboration, it's no longer yours, it's ours, and we deal with it as a thing. And I guess, like, do you have a lesson that on the other side of this big sprint of design you've been doing, really marathon of design you've been doing, that you would pass on? Forget your personal journey. Like, what kind of, like, what's the lesson you've learned, or a lesson you've learned in co-designing?
This is tough for me again, because I was thinking about this the other day. When B and I call each other, at the end of our calls, we say, I love you, and then we hang up. And I was just thinking about if you did that with, like, your boss.
So, the world would be a better place.
B and I have a very intense friendship that, like, we just know how to be close with each other. We know how to excuse each other when we're not having the best day because we work together so often. I think that we know each other so, so, so well that, it's very sibling energy, I would say, for us. And we basically grew up that way, that, like, the reason that I'm having a hard time with this is because, like, as much as B is my business partner, like, she's also kind of like a life partner in a lot of ways. So it's really hard to say, like, yeah, we know the intimacies of this. And I don't know that, like, I could give the same advice to two people who are, like, who know each other on Twitter and are like, hey, do you want to make a game together? Like, I can't equate that. I haven't tried that with someone.
Yeah. I would maybe imagine that if I were to do this with somebody who isn't Jay, there would be a much stronger delineation of responsibilities. Because, like, when I think of both the podcast and the game, there are some things where I'm like, oh, that was mostly Jay, or that was mostly me. But for the most part, like, I can't remember who came up with what. Like, you know, that's sort of the boon of our relationship. But if I was doing it with somebody else, there might be a little bit more delineation.
Yeah, so it's easy, guys. You just got to, you know, be 9 years old, find an 11-year-old that, you know, you vibe with, and then spend the next 20 years developing an intimate friendship, and then start a podcast together.
It's really that easy.
It's that easy.
It's very simple.
This just reminds me of that Key and Peele sketch where they're like, all right, we're going to rob this bank. How are we going to do it? It's a foolproof plan. First, we get jobs there. We get on the inside and we work there 8 hours a day, every day for 30 years. And they just deposit the money right into our bank accounts. And then after 30 years, we'll walk out the front door and they'll never know what happened.
But no, I do want to pull, you know, I want to pull something from here that I think we're identifying or we're circling around, which is the idea that, like, true, like, healthy, beautiful collaboration, I think, has a little bit of intangible magic to it. And I think that it's sort of one of those know it when you see it sort of situations. Like, there is probably, if you're listening to this, there's probably a person in your life where it's like, I think maybe we could do that. Like, I vibe with them. We've got that, like, brain meld, and, like, I don't know, maybe start a podcast. We need more.
I love that. That's so true. Everybody has somebody like that.
Yeah.
It might also be time to talk about the Network Defenders, which is the mini podcast you guys made specifically playing A Fool's Errand. And I was actually curious what your guys' experience was using an actual play as a playtest, and how that differed, and, like, what you learned from that experience that was different from a, like, home game playtest.
We were lucky that it was actually our second playtest that we did live, because the first one was with, like, a really, really early draft. We playtested it back around, like, episodes 54 and 55, I think. It is almost unrecognizable to the game that we're now playtesting. But that one we got to do with, you know, our main cast, who were very patient and on board and ready to get weird. And by the time we got to the second playtest, I think we had a bit of confidence under our belts. And we had a really great set of players who were accustomed to being dropped into larger campaigns and not necessarily always being able to, like, play out an entire backstory of their own. So seeing whether or not we could play out an entire backstory within three episodes using this setup where we, like, establish your motivations, which tells you a little bit about where you've been, what you're looking for now. And I think that we had success with that. I think I'm very happy with the way that everybody's individual stories panned out. And we got to use a lot of the mechanics. And then we came out of it with with some interesting new ideas that ended up changing the game even further.
We played it right after we playtested at Breakout Con in Toronto also. So that was great for helping develop the game. But in our playtest at Breakout, all of our playtesters were most excited about going to the networks, which in our game and in our world is the place where you go, essentially when you go to sleep. So humans go to the dream network, androids go to the digital network. And we had all of these playtesters who, like, as soon as they found that bit in the game doc, they were like, well, I mean, that
how
we
do
have
I get
to go there.
There.
Yeah, exactly. How do I get there? So that felt really affirming to then do this 3-episode show, The Network Defenders, which is, for some context, it's in canon in our world, but totally standalone. So you can listen to it having not heard the rest of the campaign, but it does interact with the campaign, like, tangentially. And The Network Defenders is about 3 people who go into the networks to find someone who got lost. And so we had on Nordinelli Kadir, who was in Wild Sea and I was also in Wild Sea. But also Nordinelli was our first guest on the show in episodes 19-20. And his character introduced our main cast to the networks. So we brought him back as sort of like a, you know, what is he doing in the networks when he's not interacting with our main cast? So yeah, it was a really interesting way to playtest. And again, similarly to the first time we playtested, like B said, like, just had 3 players who weren't our main cast, but were still very patient with us and were totally cool with us, like, kind of finding a lot of the mechanics as we went. But I would say that even from that point, which that aired in July, to now, it's like a completely new game.
As things change between versions, the question I'm going to ask isn't necessarily about specifics, but, like, what are the things that you find end up changing the most? Like, is it just you're finding where the heart of this game is? Is it you already knew the heart and you're changing the body around it? What is the thing that moves between versions the most?
I would say we almost found the heart after the playtest with the Network Defenders. And we mostly found it because we were writing the press release, which really demanded that you kind of knew what the game was about. And we were like, we know what the game is about. And then we started writing. We were like, okay.
Yeah, because I think as of Network Defenders, we still hadn't incorporated the big oops into Session Zero.
Yeah.
That was a huge turning point thematically and mechanically.
I feel like that's the biggest way to differentiate your own campaign from the show, probably. That's like an automatic differentiator for, like, if I'm a fan of Planet Arcana, I know what the big oops was in your show, but then I go start my own game and it's like, oh, the world's already so different from this.
Yeah, exactly. And I feel like the thing that we keep changing is just the experience. Like, every time we run into something where a player has difficulty understanding something, which was a thing that came up in Network Defenders, we fixed that. Or especially when we found a point that, like, it demanded something of the GMs that was too cognitively weighty, we would change that as well. So I feel like the biggest thing is just, like, we want to make it as streamlined while having as many of the things that we have in there as possible, which is still an ongoing process, I would say.
From the playtest that you've done, either early on or recently or from Network Defenders, what are the areas that you've find that the players are finding the most joy? Like, what are the areas of this game where you're like, that's it, that's the thing, nailed it, this is the thing that people are going to get really excited about and the reason they're going to want to come back to this game time and time again?
I think the motivations that make up your character are pretty cool. It immediately ties you into, basically, when you make your character, you select 3 major arcana, either randomly or off the list. And then each of those major arcana has 3 motivations for you to choose from. And so you have a mix of 3 motivations that make up your character. But that was one of the first things that we made for this game, actually, even in, like, the very first version. And I remember B and I were just, like, pulling 3 cards to see, like, if anything wasn't working with each other. And we made, like, 20 characters off the cuff that we were just like, oh my God, I want to play every campaign with these characters. So I feel like there's a lot of, like, inspirational juice that comes from selecting your motivations either randomly or with intention. And I feel like when we sit down and play, I see people light up when they kind of find motivations that do work with what they're trying to go for, or when they find a connection between two motivations that were random. I know that's what I like in a character generator, is like something that put like places me into the world without me having to do a ton of work to get there. So I feel like that's a big pull.
Yeah, I think like a lot of the time when I'm trying to go into a campaign cold and they're just like, show up with a character, build it from the book, that I struggle not having any box whatsoever. And I work really, really well creatively when there are some parameters. And so leaving the option to just be like, yeah, choose your own motivations if you want, or you can just draw them and make something of this, like, you know, this collection of hooks. And I also really think that people are enjoying the customization that they're able to do after that step. So once you pick your motivations, we have 6 archetypes, but you can combine any 2 of those archetypes. And then in addition to that, there are like specific abilities that you must spend experience to choose. So anytime you play the game, like you're going to have the option to make one of like a billion different combinations of motivations, archetypes, obligations, and that is very exciting to me, and I hope other people.
I have found a lot of joy recently. I feel like we talked about this recently, of when I first got into role-playing games, I was always the person of like, I'm never going to use a source book, or I'm going to homebrew everything. It's going to come from, you know, my mind or whatever. And like, that was satisfying. And the further I go down, like trying new and different games, the more I'm like, random table, that's actually going to be better than anything I could come up with. It's like I am so limited by my own experience. When you put 3 random words together, that will trigger more imagination than you could if you just like have to sift and find a thing and then iterate.
Yeah,
you just get 3 random ass things.
It's like, hey, imagine something right now.
Exactly. It's like, there's a water bottle.
It's like, imagine something dark, big, and stinky.
Whoa. Exactly, yeah.
Oh, I love those adjectives.
Kind of the last thing I wanted to touch on with the Network Defenders, as we kind of start pivoting to talk about the campaign for A Fool's Errand, is how was your experience of using actual play of a game as a kind of hype builder for an upcoming release?
Ooh. It was a really cool experience, I think, because our network, Rusty Quill, was really quite helpful in getting the word out. And we had some ads playing on the Magnus archives at the same time. And so our listens just went bananas, which was awesome. but yeah, maybe this can transition to the next part, but I've run a crowdfunding campaign before. B's run a crowdfunding campaign before. I asked for $500 Canadian dollars, which is like $5 US dollars, for my game, which was very achievable. And we're asking for a lot more now. And so I have literally seen how much bigger our reach is from having all these multiple points of entry to the game, like whether you know me from my game, whether you know B from her game, whether you know us as Planet Arcana. I personally like to listen to actual plays of games that I might want to buy, because that makes me want to buy it. What more can I say?
So, Jane B., as we move to a close, I want to get into a little bit of just the details of this campaign, which, if all goes as planned, is funding right now as people are listening to this. When does this campaign run, and what can people find on the Kickstarter campaign?
For sure. Our campaign runs until November 15th, and we are raising funds for the print runs. So our featured tier is the physical copy of the book. It is digest size, just over 150 pages. It's going to be filled with some absolutely incredible art, both by B and a few additional commissioned artists. It's got world building that's been cooking for over 3 years, and it's just a really unique tarot system that I think will fuel many, many campaigns for your table. The physical book is going for $50 Canadian. The digital version is going for $20 Canadian. We have a few additional higher tiers that include things like a thank you in the book, a tier where you can contribute a suggested fool name that will appear in the book, and of course, a tier where B and I run the game for you and your friends. Our stretch goals include more feature interior art, bonuses for the team. We are keeping our goals very achievable so that we can focus just on making the best version of the game.
Hell yeah. So, but before we move into our outro, a thing that we're curious about is you guys are creeping towards 100 episodes of Planet Arcana, kind of nearing the close of this major campaign. For Arc 2, do you guys plan to use Fool's Errand as the main system for the show moving forward?
My dream is that we play campaigns that become games every time. And a Fool's Errand is like, it's almost like the closing chapter of what this campaign of Planet Arcana was. And it's a memory book. And like, it would be really cool to play it again. But I have my sights set on what's the next game and campaign, to be honest.
Ooh. It might be a little spooky.
Yeah, we do have plans for the next, like, smaller campaign, which will be spooky.
Can you give us a one-word tease?
Spooky.
Island.
Oh, B, you should give a little something, because the island's really fucking cool.
Okay, there is a real-life mysterious incident known as the Vela incident, which took place off of the Kerguelen Islands. It was two flashes recorded on various radar. Nobody knows what caused these flashes. There are theories. It has never been solved. The island is about a handful of players who, for various reasons, are coerced into going down to the island to solve the mystery of the Vela incidents.
Very cool.
Spooky.
It is spooky.
Very spooky. Oxenfree, if you played Oxenfree.
Yes, and in fact, I was when I started running the island, which was the precursor to Planet Arcana. Like, it was what made us decide to record and have a podcast.
Yeah.
I love that. So, dear listeners, stay tuned for the spooky next chapter from our friends at Planet Arcana.
Ooh, it feels crazy to have said it on the recording.
Yeah,
I'm
so excited. Literally the first time we've talked about it at all.
An exclusive scoop. JB, our final question that we like to ask all of our guests is, what are you bringing to the table? And this is just our cute way of asking for a recommendation that you'd like to give to our listeners right now, other than go back a Fool's Errand immediately.
But let's be very clear. You should go back a Fool's Errand and you should go listen to Planet Arcana. Those are two official stances of this podcast.
Yeehaw.
And if you've gotten this far and you haven't done it, you're not a fan. And we don't.
Whoa.
We're taking a hard time.
You have to do at least one of them right now.
Right now, dude.
We don't have a lawyer that can check that statement, but that's okay.
B, what are you bringing to the table?
I'm bringing the Arkham Living card game. I really enjoy it. I think that it is a card game that leaves open a lot of room for RP, at least it is when I play it. It's horror based, and I like it because it's a scary card game.
Hell yeah. And Jay, what do you got for us?
I am bringing someone who has never played a TTRPG to the table, because those are the kind of people that I want to play with right now. If I could have a very small aside, I got pushed a YouTube video yesterday that was about this guy who his girlfriend wanted to try one of the games that he was playing that was Hollow Knight, but she had never played video games before because she didn't grow up with them. And so when she started playing it, she didn't have the language of video games. Like, she didn't know that you could try to find like the sprint button, or, you know, that you could double jump and stuff like that. And when you don't grow up with that kind of stuff or you're not entrenched in it, you don't think to look for that. And it's really valuable to play with people who don't speak that language for a myriad reasons. Like, you know, for first of all, as a game designer, you realize what you're not communicating, but also it makes you look at stuff differently. And so I'm really excited about playing stuff with people who are not familiar with TTRPGs.
Very good recommendation.
I also just want to have a quick aside that I love that we've adapted the term as a society of, it used to be, I found a YouTube video. Now it's, I was pushed a YouTube video.
Hilarious. Against my will.
I was served.
Yeah. Algorithms are here and they're fucking us up.
I did not order this, but I did eat it.
Thank you so much, Jay and B, for coming to the table today. One more time, do you want to let our folks know where they can find A Fool's Errand and then where they can find y'all on the internet?
We have a vanity URL. You could go to www.afoolserrandgame.com and that will take you exactly where you need to go. And then if you want to find out what I'm saying about it or other stuff that I'm doing or working on, find me on Twitter at Strautmask. That's Strautmask.
You can find me at Marsolier_B on Twitter. My freshly unbanned account, Marsolier_B. And on Instagram, in case I do get banned again, mar.sol.lier.
They'll never keep you down.
I'm a badass.
We'll make sure to put all those links in our show notes below. And if you want more gaming content from us, check out the 20-sided newsletter and the many-sided media Discord. Both of those are linked in our show notes. As always, please rate, review, and follow wherever you get your podcasts. And that's what the table is talking about. Bye-bye, everybody.
Oh, sorry.
Bye. Oh, that stays
in. It stays in.
Bye-bye.
Oh, my God.
Bye.